Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Hindu Studies podcast, the podcast channel on New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran, and today I have the distinct pleasure of speaking with not one and not two, but three editors of a really exciting new Bloomsbury publication, Bollywood Horrors, Religion, Violence, and Cinematic Fears in India. I have the pleasure of speaking with Brian Collins, Aditi Sen, and Ellen Goldberg. Hello, everybody.
Raj. Thank you for having us. This is really, really a wonderful thing.
Yes, it is a wonderful thing. And as I said, I've never had three folks, I guess four of us all together at the same time, but these are innovative times we live in. So that was the voice of Ellen Goldberg, for those of you who may not know that.
Hi, this is Aditi.
That's Aditi. And Brian Collins, you may be familiar with because we've interviewed him on his Parashurama book a couple months ago.
Right.
So, you know, the obvious question, I mean, I ask this question for every book, but maybe it's a little more prescient question than usual. Bollywood Horrors, Religion, Violence, and Cinematic Fears in India. How did this project come about? What's the genesis of this fascinating idea?
Ellen, I would ask you to start, or do you want me to start?
Sure. You know, I don't know where to start exactly because there's a bit of a history to this, but to make it short, it's born out of a deep friendship, I think, between Aditi and I. And we organized a panel at the American Academy of Religion in San Antonio, Texas, in, I guess it was 2016, just after the 2016 US election. And the four panelists who were on that were Kathleen Erndl, Aditi Sen, Brian Collins, and myself. And we met afterward and decided that this was such a successful panel that we should turn it into a book. And we all agreed about that. And then about 3 months later, February, I'm not exactly sure what date it was, we got word that Kathleen had passed away. And I think this in some ways fortified Aditi and I that we should definitely not only continue with the book, but also then dedicate it to her memory. It was kind of a legacy of her scholarship and her I think profound love of Bollywood. So that's how this got started. And then in the process, because Brian was the only other panelist who was there at the original AAR panel, we decided that it was appropriate and right, and we loved him and we wanted to include him as one of the editors. So that's how this sort of got started. Did I miss
anything?
Well, you know, Ellen and I have very different ideas of horror. So I think that was one of the main things that decided on the theme of the book. So I am a very traditional horror fan. I like my ghosts and spooks. And she is not as such a great horror fan. So I would keep telling her, try watching this, try doing that. And she always said, but for me, you know, this kind of real violence, something like this is way more horrifying. So that's when we were discussing or putting the panel, that was one of the first things that she said, why don't we extend our definition of horror so that you and I, so as she says, friendship is at the center of it. But she said, why don't you and I do something like that together and, you know, make horror way more inclusive and add more things. That's how it started, the whole thing, really.
So what are the ways in which you use the term horror in the book? What sorts of data are you looking at?
Well, there's three. The first is horror as a genre. And Ellen brought in a philosopher and a theorist of horror to the sort of conversation named Noel Carroll. And Noel Carroll has a distinction between art horror and natural horror. Now, the term art horror for me is difficult because it evokes images of art house horror, like really highbrow horror films. But really what it means is horror aesthetics. So things that are meant to look scary, ghosts, haunted houses, spider webs, all the things you see on Halloween, which we're now in the middle of. And then there's natural horror, which is things that you are naturally horrified of. So art horror would include vampires and ghosts, but natural horror could be a serial killer or some horrible historical event. So there's two things here. So horror is a genre. Art horror or aesthetic horror is one of the things we're interested in, especially exclusively as it manifests in Bollywood. And then the second goes along with the natural horror idea, the cinematic portrayals of real life horror, which we also see in Bollywood, and sometimes which overlap with the first kind of horror. And then the third idea of horror, which is why the book is called Bollywood Horrors, is the experience of horror. And that's what led us and me and also Kathleen and also Aditi to think about Rasa theory, Sanskrit aesthetics, in its way of understanding felt emotions and responses to stimuli. So we looked at horror as a genre, horror movies, traditionally horror movies, horror as it's portrayed on the screen, real life horrors as they're expressed, and then how you feel watching both.
And the book is set up in three sections, one governed by each of those themes. So we start off, the book starts off with a couple of contributions by Ryan himself. So maybe you can tell us a bit about what you're showing in your work there.
Okay, yeah, right. Well, I have been a fan of these Indian horror movie posters ever since I first went to India and saw them. And I started collecting them. There's only a few places you can get them, and they're sort of not around anymore because they make them all with computers now, but they're collectible. They are found in bazaars, really in Mumbai, in Chor Bazaar in Mumbai and a couple of other places. And I've always thought they were fascinating objects, and I thought they had some significance, and I wanted to write about them. So I went to a panel that Aditi and Ellen had done actually before the panel I was part of. And I met Aditi and we talked about our mutual love of the genre and its ephemera. And then when I started thinking about this volume in the paper that I gave, I wanted to look at the images that are on these posters and in these song booklets advertising Bollywood horror movies in terms of Sanskrit aesthetics, in terms of Rasa. And that's how I started out. But then I continued to write more and more. And eventually I ended up with like a 100-page essay that they refused to publish because it was too long. And I had to break it up, and I broke it up into one part that talked about the posters and the song booklets, the advertising materials, and as material objects, and how they circulate, and how they're preserved, and why they're preserved, and what sort of language of imagery they use. And then the second part was sort of started off as a footnote. I was researching the idea of horror in India, and I came across a book called The Gothic Flame by a guy named Devendra P. Varma. And it was a book about Gothic horror written in the mid 20th century by an Indian scholar of English literature. And so I was interested in it, and I got to know a little bit more about him, and I fell down a rabbit hole, eventually connected with his family in Canada, got into his archive, and found out this was an incredible story of this man who started out in what's now Nepal and Bihar, a high caste Hindu sometimes a Buddhist, fought for the British in World War II. And this is not a joke, in a famous operation called Operation Dracula in Thailand. And then he became a scholar, a professor of English literature. He knew Gandhi. He knew Nehru quite well. He was a cousin of Nehru's. He moved to Canada. He gave tours of Dracula's castle in Transylvania, which is not actually Dracula's castle, but that's a long story. He held horror movie marathons or horror movie screenings anyway at the college he taught at Dalhousie and became known as Vampire Man Varma because of his popularization of classic vampire stories. So I never heard of this guy. I don't know how I missed him. And he appears virtually nowhere except for in the very small Gothic literature reviews and books. But as far as to do with India, I've never seen anything with him. So I decided to write about him. And that was the second part that the second essay that I did. So the first one's about posters. The second one is about Varma and his contributions to the adoption of Gothic horror tropes in the West.
Varma is a fascinating figure, goes without saying. And it seems you have a knack for highlighting the work of fascinating figures based on some of your projects, Brian.
It's a hobby. Yeah. No, it's more than a hobby. It is. I'm drawn to it. And I think that a compelling narrative is a good way I think academic work should have a compelling narrative because people get interested in it and you can actually have people think about it that way. If you're reading something because you're interested to hear what's going to happen next, that not all academic writing is like that, but I think it's nice when it can be.
Well, it's the, it's the power of story, right? It's telling a story. Even while you're giving a talk or presentation, I mean, you need to tell a story for nonfiction. Some of the best scientists in the world are the ones that can present their material through an accessible narrative, right?
Oh, I think that's true. Exactly.
Fascinating. Maybe let's take a look at the second part of this fascinating volume. Aditi, do you want to talk about that a bit?
Yeah. So I come from somebody who grew up in India and grew up through ghost stories. And so that's my fascination with horror. And Raz actually happened to be one of my all-time favorite films. So, and when I kind of first saw the film, actually, the film was, when it released, it was quite interesting. I was first very interested in the tagline, "Do you want to know the secret?" I thought that was a good, "Do you want to know the Raz?" And that sort of drew me to that film. And when I saw it, my first impression was, oh, this is, in essence, Savitri and Satyavan, which he's twisted. That's fairly clever. It got terrible reviews. It was supposed to be bad. I thought it was quite very, very good. In fact, I do like Vikram Bhatt's work. Now, before this, I have met Tulsi Ramsey. I was writing an article on, B horror films, on how they're low-budget films, which I did for a conference in Vilnius. And that paper got published and things like that. After that, I thought it would be interesting to get to talk to Vikram Bhatt on his films. So I met Vikram Bhatt. We had a long conversation on folktale, ghost stories. And my work is actually looking not just at tropes that has always worked in Indian cinema, mainly Gothic. So I'm interested in the Gothic setup, ghost story, folklore he borrows from, and why his films are so successful. You will not find a horror director who is, besides Tulsi Ramsey, and they had Purana Mandir and few other hits, but nobody's had been more successful. Nobody's been more successful than Vikram Bhatt, actually, commercially, if you think of it. And I was interested in commercial success as well as subversion and mental health. So my Think Talks of Three, because it's also about madness. Raz is also about madness. And it was just, thinking way back, we had that suicide, Shashank Singh Rajput's suicide, and the talk on mental health took a backseat. So this whole thing about the whole problem of mental health and horror has been, from The Shining to everything, has been very attractive to me. And I think Vikram Bhatt has actually handled it without sort of being very, let's say he's not been very subtle about it, but he has the way he treats, he's the one to talk about madness. And we don't have a lot of horror film. Maybe Pari in recent days talked a little bit about madness, maybe Gehrai, but I think horror film today is getting more and more trying new zones. That's the new thing in India. You have Bulbul, which is, of course, the Netflix film that's come out, which I was telling them that film has got a lot of elements that we cover in the book, from vigilantism to mental health to feminism to all sorts of issues that it's trying to unpack. Yeah, that's I'm going by tradition and how that within that tradition there's possibility of subversion in horror film.
Now, just to clarify for our listeners, this the illusion or the inversion of the very famous narrative of Savitri and Satyavan, are you saying that's conscious? Is that purposeful?
So I asked, actually, I asked Vikram if, that Savitri Satyavan, was it what happened? Like, were you really consciously thinking of it? And he said, of course. In fact, what happened was I wanted the film to end with that she saves his life, but she divorces him. That, you know, it doesn't have to end happily. That was my first draft. And then I said, well, this is India. I have to make my film a success. If Savitri is saving Satyavan, she has to, you know, she has to stay there. She has to be there. So he is very conscious. He is very, very interested in, and, you know, he made another film called Creature. And that, while it's not a very good film, it is about a Brahmarakshas that's coming out of a tree. So he is interested in his folklore, and he's very, very interested in getting into this. Even though he'll borrow a structure that's Hollywood, he is still going to go for something that's very, very Indian. Having said that, while Raz, of course, clearly has similarity with What Lies Beneath, there was a film called Mangal Sutra that came way before What Lies Beneath, and it's a very similar story too. So it's got a kind of interesting subtext there. I always think, yes, he borrowed the structure. He kept it a mystery. In the end, you come to know that the husband's not a good guy and things like that. So his treatment is very good. I think his treatment is what makes it more successful too. He's not telling you a very unique story. Raz, if you think about the story, it's not unique. It's the treatment that makes it very... And it wasn't understood as a good film or something. In later years, though, people do acknowledge that Raz is an interesting film. So, and it was hugely successful. Yeah.
That's fascinating. Do you want to say a word about the other two contributions to that section? Maybe first we can begin with Horrifying and Sinister Tantrics.
I can talk about Hughes. So Hugh Urban was actually, when we wanted to do the book, he was the first one we approached because Hugh Urban can write an article in about 10 minutes. And I thought it'd be easy to start bulking this thing up with him. He's also lives down the highway from me in Columbus, Ohio. So he had been working already on the image of the Tantrika in horror films, like as a stock villain. Of course, he's also a stock character in Indian drama. And so he's looking at that too. So he had a piece called Horrifying and Sinister Tantrics. And he actually had in some images that he had taken in India, which we ended up couldn't use because of copyright stuff. We had a hard enough time using the 10 images that I got. I had to hire a guy to go to Mumbai and find these rights for all these producers, which was a undertaking. But anyway, with Hughes, he's really going down the David Gordon White path of the development of the character of the Tantrika or the evil yogin through folklore, and then, you know, extending that to cinema. And so his is sort of a typology of this character. It's really, I think, an important contribution because it sort of stands as like almost like an encyclopedia article where you can get from there a real clear picture of this stock character of the black magician associated with all the stereotypes about Tantra in film. Then the other one that Kathleen Erndl had contributed, the one that she gave the talk on in San Antonio. You know, she passed away suddenly and very unexpectedly, so she had never had a chance to revise it. So we did very little revision. Ellen went through it and did a few things with her partner's permission in Florida. But she was really interested in, because her work is about the goddess. So we have a big picture of the goddess in the front with a dedication to her, looking at the goddess as a prototype for a wronged woman getting her revenge. This is another cinematic trope. So both of those other articles from part two, I mean, so we do want to know the Raz is about a Hollywood filtered myth, and then these other two are about an avenging goddess reimagined as a wronged woman getting her revenge, and the horrifying and sinister tantric of Sanskrit drama reimagined as a movie villain. So that section is called Cinematic Horror Iconography and Aesthetics.
Yes, it was fascinating. I didn't realize until I had read this book for this podcast that the late great Kathleen Erndl had contributed to this before her sudden passing. It was really nice to read her paper, and she mentions this text called the Devi Mahatmya that I've heard of once or twice. So I just conjure up this third episode, Devi Mahatmya, where they come to the Ma Devi, you know, in all of her splendor, and like they're like, you know, if you don't come with us, if you speak that way, we're gonna drag you by your hair. You know, this motif, right? And she's very coquettish, and eventually she obviously prevails. But her paper is quite rich, actually. There's a lot in there. A lot of themes that can be teased out.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
100%. I wish, and of course, we wish that she was still around and that she had the chance to develop it more. But yeah, you can see there the germ of a whole new direction. A sort of an updating of the idea. I mean, she's looking at it in all these ancient and medieval contexts. But yeah, I agree with you, and I'm very pleased that we were able to conclude it.
Wonderful. So Ellen, do you want to talk a little bit about your contribution and/or the third section that it occurs in?
Sure. So I mean, as Aditi said, you know, during conversations that we've had over the years, exploring our differences and my lack of knowledge of art horror, Bollywood art horror, and my feeling that we really do need to expand the definition of horror if we're going to work together to a place that I can include something, sort of got us talking about this notion of cultural horror, which I think is in a kind of a semantic extension of Noel Carroll's natural horror. But for me, it's something that is then a kind of cinematic portrayal of real life horror. And this could be in any of the arts. I mean, it could be in film, it could be in literature, it could be in drama, it could be in, you know, whatever. So I think there are a number of examples we could have included in the book beyond the ones that we did include. We include my chapter on fundamentalism or on communalism. We have Morgan Odie's chapter on rape by looking at Bandit Queen. And of course we have Beth's chapter on child trafficking. So these were three of the chapters that we included in the cultural horror section. In my particular chapter, I look at Govind Nihalani's 2002 film on Dev. And I think that what we see here is a really profound graphic depiction of this real life horror of the recurring Hindu-Muslim communal violence that took place in Gujarat. And what I try to do really in the chapter is to show, first by looking at sort of the history of communalism as briefly as I can, of course, to unpack some of that, to show how we have these recurring haunting effects of social trauma that were, I'm going to track back as far as partition, let's say, okay, colonialism, decolonization, partition, and so on. And although Dev is certainly depicting a fictionalized account of the 2002 riots in Gujarat. I think that it is certainly a powerful reconstruction, fictional reconstruction of that cultural horror moment. And so I tried to tease out some of the complex narrative by looking at some theorists, including Hannah Arendt and her depiction of the banality of evil. I look at Freud and his theories of the uncanny. And I think that both of those really do help to kind of explore the work of repression and show how the ghosts of the past continue to haunt us, right? Especially if, as Bhaskar says, there isn't a way to mourn what has happened, right? So I think the horror that we see reaches what Tanaka Sarkar says is a kind of a point of unspeakable brutality. And I know that my chapter is probably the most depressing of all of the chapters in the book, but I think it's also something that needs to be talked about and understood and unpacked and theorized and analyzed. I guess also one of the other things that I think I was trying to talk about really is to show how art, in this case film, can really be a cathartic way to express trauma and to kind of mediate the unspeakable, things that we can't talk about. My partner is an expressive art therapist, and so she works with art and different modalities. And I've always learned from her that there are ways that we can't just talk about things, that we need other modalities to express them. And I think that art can be one of those ways. And so one of the things that I say in my conclusion, and I was actually at a conference in Paris, I guess it was two summers ago when we could still travel. And I was approached by a number of people who came to the panel about how there has never really been any kind of memorialization of what has happened around partition. And if it's true that Nehru didn't provide the space for people to mourn what happened for whatever political reasons, then I think that something like Dev and other films that depict these kinds of moments of cultural horror belong in a kind of archive of truth and reconciliation, so that we can pay homage to and learn from a kind of transmission of cultural memory, where we can really understand where these ghosts of recurring violence, why they recur over and over and over again. So that was sort of my kind of purpose in writing this particular chapter. I can't speak to Morgan so much other than to say that we were at a departmental meeting, and I asked her if she would be interested in writing a chapter on Bandit Queen, and she said, "Let me watch it." And I thought about her that weekend watching that film. And I was sure she was going to say, "I can't do that." And she came back the next week and said, "I would love to write something about that. It's in her field." And maybe Aditi can speak more about that, because I think I was on sabbatical while the two of them were doing that discussion. But, and again, the same with Mardani and Beth's chapter on Mardani, you know, talking about child trafficking, profoundly cultural horror. It's cultural horror, right?
Well, we know a thing or two about cultural horrors, I think, as you mentioned one of you mentions in the preface of the book. And how well timed is this podcast, without being consciously timed, that we're more or less around the time of Halloween, where the ghosts and ghouls come out, and we're also just on the cusp of a very important moment in the history of the Earth, also known as the American elections. So if when you say your chapter is perhaps the most depressing, if you mean perhaps the most evocative, then I might be inclined to agree.
It is ironic in a way, but it is 4 years after the election that this book is now going to be published. It's really a completion on some very deep, profound level, I think.
We hadn't planned on a 4-year process, I should say. This wasn't the intent.
It's highly veiled cultural criticism at the exact moment that it's needed. Good job. And they see what we do with the academy isn't relevant. Look at this.
Exactly.
I have two sort of broad questions. As you probably well know, I play the part of naive interlocutor, sort of I call it a 30,000-foot view to get a sense of the book for those who may be interested in delving further for research or interest or teaching. I was going to ask the question separately, but because of the unique texture of the book in terms of its discipline, I'll ask them in tandem and you can kind of answer them together if you'd like. One question that comes to mind is, well, who might be interested in this book? You know, who's this book for? And the other question that comes to mind is, where does this book fit in scholarship? Like what is it in dialogue with, or what is it sort of, is it branching off and doing its own thing? Is it continuing conversations in different, you know, echo chambers previously? Like where does that fit? And maybe those questions can relate in some way.
I'd love to start answering this and then pass it on. So yeah, these are the questions that we were asked ourselves many times and that we were asked many times by publishers. And I think to me, the who's it for? So I saw a lot of interesting work being done about Southeast Asian and East Asian horror films in their cultural contexts. And I didn't see much of anything about South Asia. Now, that started to change around the time we were working on this in the 2010s, in the middle of the 2010s, and some good work has come out. And which we try to give it all as it was up to the minute in our preface. But there's a Indian horror has been overlooked mainly in world cinema. It's treated as an oddity, as a kind of a joke because of the low budgets and because of the juxtaposition of this singing and dancing disco scenes with this, you know, monster with the plastic fangs. But, you know, this is also, you know, it's important to think of this as a lot of this is emergency cinema. This is coming out of a very traumatic moment. And so I think that people that want to understand Indian culture post-liberalism really, and the elements of religion and we would say maybe the para-religious elements about things like possession and demonology, you know, and we could talk about where religion ends and where magic begins, but maybe a different time. But you see here a lot of material that has not been closely looked at by religionists. Now, cinematic scholars are starting to look at it, but religionists haven't been. And for us, there's a lot of the questions that were raised are about religion. I mean, so the idea of natural horror versus art horror. Art horror or aesthetic horror, Noel Carroll says that's what it is because the things in those movies or those stories disturb the natural order. So if it's just a scary person or like a scary dog, yeah, you might be horrified. But if it's a demon, then you have to give up your whole worldview about what's rational and what's real. And that's the trauma of it. So in India, it's really not clear where that line is because possession is not as out of ordinary thing in temple traditions, especially around the goddess or even others. So there are things in culture that, I mean, tantricas are real people too. I mean, they don't do the same things in movies, but they're also real. Aghoris are real people. So you can't say, oh, this is just a fake movie. And then go outside of the theater and see that person standing on the corner asking for money or whatever. So we really have to think about this in religious terms. And that's what I wanted to do with this is to take, make this material available, show what it is and what kind of questions we can ask of it. And so that other religious studies scholars can go forward with a project or can start asking their own kind of questions. And then the idea of who wants the book? Is that the other part of the question? Or?
Who might be interested?
Yeah, right. Who might be interested? I think we've appealed to people who are interested in world cinema. I mean, I horror fans tend to be pretty nerded out, right? I mean, I understand me and Aditi know this because we're horror fans. That, you know, I was before I ever went to graduate school, I would read any book about horror fiction or horror movies, to just to learn more about the history and including global cinema. So I think that there is a sort of a need in the, or a desire in the fandom world to kind of expand their knowledge or deepen their knowledge of the history of the genre that they are so into. Of course, I don't know how close we're going to get to breaking into that market, probably not very, but for other people though, this would be a totally unknown part of Indian culture that then can be, I think, sort of trotted out as something you should take a look at.
Absolutely. Even as someone like myself who fancies himself a scholar of Hinduism, I mean, there's so much content here that is definitely overtly religious that I wouldn't have been aware of, and perhaps might even have overlooked because of the ways in which we receive horror or even think about cultural horror. Aditi or Ellen, do you have anything you wanted to add about the conversation about sort of scholarship or interests or readership of the book?
So I will actually add a little bit about adding Beth into the Beth is a very, very good friend of mine, and she is fairly famous on Twitter as Beth Loves Bollywood. So she and I actually met on Twitter because of her love for cinema, and she loves 70s films. But then we met, and I told her that we were thinking of this book, and she said, but she's not a big horror fan. Like she watches the Ramses only for horror, so she's not, she enjoys, but she's not. And then I told her, well, you like Mardani. That's one of the films she loved. And that's how, and Beth is a museum curator. So her interest purely came from as a lover of Hindi cinema. And then in some ways, her journey, as she went back and forth, discussed, she does know India very well, though she's been there. So for her to actually unpack the whole journey of, looking at, well, I never thought of Mardani as an avenging goddess, but she's a police, she's a cop, and what it becomes duty. So all that in her process also, she discovered this whole new field, and she has this very good, chapter. But I think in some ways our point for who will be interested is also people who are interested in Bollywood. Anyone who's taken a lot of interest in Bollywood, and I'm using Beth as a classic example, she loves Bollywood and she's in this book. And that's the interest too. That's, I think, anyone who has been interested in Indian cinema, how Bollywood works, that would be. I mean, and this book has a very, it's not a cinema studies book. It is more for religious understanding. None of us come from really cinema studies field at all, but we are looking at a very different way of understanding. So I think anyone who likes Bollywood and is interested in religion and Hinduism in India would be very interested in this book. That's at least my understanding of it.
Yeah. I mean, I would only add that I think it would make a great book for a course.
Without question.
Yeah, I mean, I came to this also through a course that I was teaching and with Aditi's help. And it's when I went to look for course materials that address these kinds of issues specific to religious studies students, I really couldn't find very much. And so I think this would be great for that. And the other thing I just want to say is I also, this idea of creating this category called cultural horror, I think this could also be a standalone next book for someone. I would like to see this open up to more discussion around these kinds of issues in art, particularly film for me, but it could be in any other kind of venue. So I would like to see that also happen. You know, it's not just about where it's come from, but where it could go to.
I'm glad that you made that point, because I was partially hoping you would. I try as best as possible not to put words in people's mouths on these podcasts in particular, but for me, I could easily see this somewhat starting various trends or sub-trends in scholarship, because it's a novel combination that's not not outlandish, right? It's a, you know, I mean, for me, the most accessible point of access is Kathleen Arundel's work, because I happened to study the goddess and Sanskrit narrative. And obviously, I mean, I was quoting her from my undergrad days, right? I mean, she, right. So, and there's so much there, just there's so much that can be developed.
Right.
So I can only imagine our colleagues in other subfields studying Hinduism or Indian cinema or whatnot. I can only imagine the synapses that may fire were they to kind of have a look at what you put together here.
And also, I think it's, you know, it's a very creative project that goes beyond just looking at Lagan, you know, which is one of the typical films that you might find in a religion and a Bollywood and religion course or the Journal of Film Studies. So I think it's really, it's experts in their fields writing about things that they know best and relating them to these topics that they've chosen, whether it's racism or whether it's Savitri, it doesn't matter, but it's these really mature scholars who are bringing the best that they have to unpack these films that haven't been unpacked by experts like this before.
Mm. Now, are the strands of scholarship in this volume, are any of you pursuing them elsewhere? Like, are you working on similar themes or projects currently?
I think Aditi is.
No, I'm actually doing something. My next that's coming out is, it should be out next year soon because it's already gone to the press, is a chapter on Hindi comics and horror. So it's sort of similar, but it's on a collection on South Asian Gothic, and it's about Gothic themes. So it's sort of an extension, but on Hindi comics though. So I'm looking at a whole range of Hindi comics that has been, those have nothing to do with Amar Chitra Katha that has been the foundation, but I'm looking at all kinds of different types of Hindi comics and horror comics, exclusively horror comics. So that's, yeah. And Brian actually knows a bit about Hindi horror comics. When I told him what I was working on, he immediately said, "Have you covered Friendly? That's Chucky." I'm like, "Yes, yes, Brian."
Friendly is pretty great.
Friendly is good, yes. So
I actually, one thing that really, I got interested, a new approach for me that I used in this collection or my essay on the posters in the song booklets was to look at them as objects rather than just something that holds the text, as a physical object that has been around for a while and that has had different owners and that it has washed up in the Chor Bazaar next to a bunch of other weird stuff that they sell to tourists and collectors. And so I thought, well, you know, I just don't think much about, you know, objects. And so I started reading Arjuna Padarai's work on things. And it was really eye-opening. And I thought I'd take that approach of looking at them as physical objects in situ, photographing them and not cropping out the edges where the brittle paper is coming apart, but actually show not just the image of the poster, but this actual poster, which is now, you know, on this campus in a little flat file. So I got one object though that I had to leave out of the study because I just didn't have room. Was there was a brief period, and it was cresting. It was about the end when I was in India, in 2008 or so, of VCDs and VCDs, video CDs. They were meant to be a format that came between VHS and DVD, but they didn't really launch in the US and DVDs came out and there was no need for VCDs because they're much smaller. They only hold 800 megabytes or whatever. But they became popular in parts of Asia, including in India. And so, because they're light, they're cheap, put them in a paper or plastic envelope with a mimeograph of whatever movie you've pirated and sell them. So I sort of have a lot of these VCDs and they also are repositories of really strange original art. And maybe you have a lot of religious devotional movies sitting right next to pirated copies of Freddy versus Jason, right? Or Spider-Man. And so I those VCDs I thought were, people have written about them in Southeast Asia and in Japan. Interesting stuff. So I wanted to do a piece about that, and I've got it on the back burner of the back burner. At some point, though, I will return to the circulation of video compact discs in the 2000s, specifically horror ones.
Fascinating. Was there anything about the volume you hope to be touched on in this interview that we haven't as of yet?
Well, one thing I'd say is that, you know, we kind of assumed from the beginning of this conversation, oh, everybody knows what Hindi horror is because we've been talking about it for 4 years amongst each other. But most people a lot of people are just unaware that these films exist because they're except for recently, they weren't classically the blockbusters. There was a period in the late 80s when there were a few, but they are not the typical Indian successful film. Some of them are very low budget and only played like at noon or at midnight in theaters where only people that were seeking them out would see them. And so there is a genre of film that really goes back to the beginning of Indians, or at least to the 20s and 30s when the Gothic themes started getting imported, of ghosts, sometimes reincarnation stories that are ghostly, other times demons from Indian folklore and mythology that has a level of popularity cult fandom in India. They are less well known than your major Bollywood films or Tollywood films, but if you've never seen one, then you can just Google the Ramsay brothers and they've got four or five really big ones that you can see. So if this all sounds completely new, then you've got to kind of first find an Indian horror movie to see what we're talking about. They're quite unique.
Yes, I suppose we should have started with that question, shouldn't we have?
blame me.
That's fine. I'm sure people will Google it or some such thing. Great. So unless there's something else you wanted to touch on, shall we close for today? Ellen, was there something you wanted to say?
I'm good. I feel complete. Okay.
It's whole. We arrived at the completion.
We did.
Of the sacrifice. Wow, here we go.
Well, one thing, Pratishta, I should say, Pratishta, is that I did leave out, we have color plates in this, yes. In this film. Yeah. I mean, that we went to some link at the book. We went to some links to get glossy color plates of these posters, some of which have never been reproduced anywhere else. So that is if you want a reason to get the book, that's it.
Sure. If you want a very erudite comic book, something to brighten your day in the most nerdy possible Hindu studies way, then get this book. So for those of you listening, we have been speaking for the first time ever with three individuals on the same podcast with Ellen Goldberg, Aditi Sen, and Brian Collins, who are all editors of Bollywood Horrors, Religion, Violence, and Cinematic Fears in India, a brand new Bloomsbury academic publication. Thank you all for appearing on the podcast today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Until next time, stay safe, keep reading, keep listening, and keep contemplating horrors of all kinds. Take care.